24 years since the September 11th attacks. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Thanks so much for joining us.
The viewpoints expressed in this program are the opinions of the people expressing them, and not necessarily those of Fresh Air Incorporated, its staff, or its board of directors.
You are listening to Fresh Air Community Radio, KFAI, 90.3 FM Minneapolis, St. Paul, and around the world at kfai.org. Non-commercial, community-powered radio. And Thursday at this time is the Northern Sun Radio News Show with your host Don Olson and Dave Gudnick. We're here. We're going to do another program on what's going on with in the Ukraine. We're going to be having Brian Berletic, who is going to be talking about the NATO panics as Ukraine front lines collapse. And he's on Professor Glenn Deason. And Brian Berletic is a former U.S. Marine, journalist, and international security analyst. Relatively young guy, but boy, does he have a lot to say. And Professor Glenn Deason. Dave, why don't you introduce him?
Yes, I've been following, thanks, Don. Glenn Deason is a Norwegian professor, and he has built quite a following internationally by being a very intelligent, a critical voice outside the mainstream, which is the Western media that is almost uniformly pro-NATO, pro-U.S., pro-war in Ukraine on Russia, and so on. And so Deason has great interviews with really informed and intelligent people, diplomatic, military, and scholarly, and others. Just want to quickly mention one other one before we get to hearing him with Brian Berletic, that Glenn Deason is a professor of international relations with a special focus on Russia. He's on YouTube as well as Substack. And he's been attacked in Norway as an academic and as a citizen just for advocating negotiations in Ukraine. And he said the political atmosphere there has become so bad that he and his wife and family are contemplating leaving Norway. And I want to mention one more Glenn Deason interview that just came out. I watched with Mike Pence, a former undersecretary of state in the United States, who's extremely well-informed on the strategy of sponsoring NGOs. There's thousands of them sponsored by the U.S. that are supposed to be civic organizations, but they're really pushing our imperial organization and color revolutions in a number of different countries. So highly recommended the interview with Mike Pence, which just came out on Glenn Deason's platform.
And Deason is spelled
D-I-E-S-E-N, Glenn Deason, and again, it's on Substack as well as YouTube. And Brian Berletic's, go ahead, Don, Brian Berletic's site is called The New Atlas, if you want to look him up. He's quite informative.
So we see that Russia, well, recently now, just launched its largest drone strikes on Ukraine with over 800 drones, also complemented with missiles, and the pressure is now intensifying across the entire front line. Now, given that the Trump is having this diplomatic efforts to end the war, he's saying again that he's disappointed and he will therefore support new sanctions. So we also see rhetoric from the political media establishment across NATO that this is evidence that Russia does not want peace. What do you make of this development?
Well, again, it's very important for people to understand what exactly this conflict is in the first place. The Trump administration itself has admitted and has, you know, blamed the previous Biden administration for starting the war, and they've characterized it as a U.S. proxy war against Russia. So it really is not up to Russia to end a war that is being waged against them by the United States. According to the Trump administration itself, it is up to the Trump administration to look at how this proxy war began, how it is being fought, and what measures need to be taken to stop it. For example, there is a U.S. military command in Germany right now overseeing the entire conflict in Ukraine. They are at the very top, the chain of command of Ukraine's armed forces, not Ukrainian generals, American generals. If President Trump put an end to that, brought these generals back home, or put them in charge of something that actually had to do with American national security, the war would end. It would end very quickly. Another factor fueling this war is the United States and its directive to the Europeans to continue funding and arming and training the Ukrainians. And again, as the Western media itself has admitted, the United States Central Intelligence Agency is running Ukraine's intelligence networks inside Ukraine right now. That is another aspect of this war that if President Trump decided, he could end overnight and the conflict would end. So he's not serious about ending this conflict. And if people look back at his rhetoric, even before the elections, he was more or less telling people that he had no intention of ending it. He told people what they wanted to hear. But if you looked at the so-called peace plans that were being proposed, he was talking about freezing the conflict, which is the overarching agenda of the United States. If you want to call it a deep state, this is what was already underway during the Biden administration. They were losing the proxy war. The prospect of Ukrainian lines collapsing were increasing. And so they wanted to freeze it. They do not want to end it. This is about pulling Russia in, tying them down, while the United States pivots to China, Iran, and elsewhere, and then circle back around to Russia later. This is referred to as strategic sequencing, and this is what policymakers involved in the current Trump administration have laid out extensively in policy papers spanning many years.
I was wondering, can you explain this concept of strategic sequencing in terms of the U.S., well, in this case, study the U.S. Proxy war against Russia?
Yes, so the U.S. establishment, whether it's headed nominally by Democrats or Republicans, seeks primacy over the entire globe. All of these policy papers connected to either administration, all they talk about is maintaining America's dominance over the entire planet. It is to remain the largest sole superpower of the globe. And in order to do this, the United States needs to prevent all peer and near-peer competitors from rising up and challenging its position globally. This is not about American national security. This is about America being able to do as it pleases worldwide, as it has for nearly a century now. And so strategic sequencing is a realization that the United States is incapable, does not have the resources to fight nations like Russia, China, Iran, and all of their allies around the globe all at the same time. They need to tie one down and then focus its resources on another. There's also this concept of division of labor, which was publicly stated by U.S. Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth back in February. The need for nations, the U.S. essentially influences and for all intents and purposes controls, have them direct public resources to American foreign policy objectives. For Europe, for example, that would be taking public resources and channeling it into this proxy war against Russia and Ukraine. For Japan or South Korea or now the Philippines, completely politically captured by the U.S., that is directing public resources that would be used for the people in these countries to building up their military and encroaching upon and encircling and containing China in the Asia Pacific region. And so strategic sequencing, right now, as it stands, the U.S. is prioritizing China as the greatest threat to its hegemony, not to America where it exists on a map, but to its hegemony over the planet. And so they need to pause the conflict in Ukraine against Russia and pivot towards China. So this is strategic sequencing. Deal with China first and then circle back around to Russia later. But they cannot allow Russia the freedom to rebuild its military, to redirect its resources in support of its allies, which includes China. That's why they need to freeze the conflict in Ukraine, not end it.
Yeah, people just have a hard time imagining that the United States, this, I assume that they want the war to come at least to a temporary halt, given that they have other priorities. But this control that not just the United States, but the political West has established over Ukrainian intelligence services, and also having now large control over hundreds of thousands of Ukrainian soldiers, which they can use to fight a strategic rival. I mean, it's hard to imagine that they simply want to give this all up because, you know, humanitarian concerns or just the desire to get along better with Russia. So it does look like the main, the best possible outcome for them would be to dial down the war a bit so as to prevent Ukraine from collapsing, but also giving the United States some time to address its other priorities around the world. Think around the whole rhetoric of helping Ukraine. One forgets that this covers up the massive investments that have been done in building this. I mean, if, as you remember as well, back in 2014, on the first day after the coup, the United States already began to set up this partnership with Ukraine from 2015, and all you had the Washington Post reporting that the U.S. was rebuilding Ukraine's intelligence services from scratch because, you know, the former ones was partnered with, well, they were partnered with Russia, so they weren't reliable. And again, the attraction of controlling these intelligence services was to use them as an instrument against the Russians. So they've been doing this for over a decade, and it's just, I can't imagine them wanting to give up this massive control. I mean, they control much of the government, the military, the intelligence services, the media, the civil society through all these NGOs. I mean, what Russia demands, a decoupling away from Ukraine. This would be, I guess, a repeat of what happened in 2010, because in 2004 we had the Orange Revolution. We had Yushchenko in instead. He was going to pull all Ukraine into the NATO orbit, decouple from Russia. But, you know, then democracy happened. This was not popular among the Ukrainians. He ended up with like 2 or 3% approval rating, and they voted in Yanukovych in 2010. And that whole long process, that huge investment was essentially lost as Ukraine began to make itself more neutral again or non-aligned. And now, NATO risks the same thing, that Ukraine will fall out of its orbit and return to some kind of neutral status. It's hard to imagine this happening, but towards that end, though, how extensive is the U.S. still involved in the war?
Tremendously, and at every single level. And so what they're realizing is that as things are going right now, if this continues, eventually Ukraine's military is going to collapse. And so they're preparing for that. Ideally, they would like to freeze it like they did when this all first began in 2014 and the Minsk I and Minsk II agreements. That was a means of saving the Ukrainian military, which was on the verge of collapsing then, freezing it and then allowing the U.S. and its client states across Europe to rebuild, reorganize, rearm Ukraine's forces for the next round of violence. So they're just seeking to do this all over again. Freeze it before they collapse, begin rearming them. And this is what the U.S. has tasked Europe with doing, because the U.S. needs to save its own resources for focusing on China, Iran, and elsewhere, as part of this strategic sequencing. The division of labor is to absolve the U.S. from primarily investing in Ukraine, free up resources for elsewhere. So that is exactly what they're doing. They have no intention at all whatsoever of making any sort of peace with Russia. And as you point out, this goes all the way back to the beginning of the 21st century, and obviously well before it. And this demonstrates continuity of agenda. It does not matter who Americans vote for, who is in the White House, who controls Congress. This is a singular agenda that continues no matter what. And despite the very vocal opposition President Trump during the campaign season had against all, you know, this so-called deep state and the forever wars abroad, he has continued absolutely every single war that he inherited from the Biden administration, just as Biden did from the Trump administration and Trump did from the Obama administration. And he has started new wars against Yemen and Iran. He is building up for war against Venezuela very openly and obviously. And they are still planning to pivot toward Asia. And so this all continues uninterrupted, and it will continue. It will not be America that restrains itself. There is no prospect of change in America politically. The special interests driving this are unelected. They are monolithic. There really is no one else in the U.S. capable of challenging or displacing them. It will be up to the multipolar world to stop and then eventually reverse this.
So that was Brian Berletic, who is speaking to the topic of NATO panics as Ukraine front lines collapse. And he's there with Professor Glenn Deason and Dave Gudnick. You have some comments?
Well, I think Brian made a number of good points that I want to make sure we're not run by too quickly. I like his comparison of the present hope, given the Ukraine is being defeated, Russia is advancing, that there be a freeze, and the parallel is with 2014, 2015, when Ukraine was again forced to the negotiating table immediately after the Russian military special operation, and turns out those agreements in 2014 and 2015 at Minsk were simply used, as admitted later by Chancellor Merkel and others who were signatories, was simply used as a ploy to rearm Ukraine and prepare Ukraine military for war on Russia. So there's a parallel, perhaps, with what's going on today, because they want to freeze, as Brian Berletic was indicating, so they can focus on additional, not totally separate, but additional areas of conflict. I also like his point that there's a continuing aim of the U.S. being the sole superpower, which gripped our rulers at least from the 1990s, and I think we're still suffering from the arrogance and all the damage that this kind of attitude does, that we are going to be the sole superpower and not allow any peer competitors. Also, I want to mention, they talked about using Ukraine and European intelligence against Russia. In my opinion, is we've actually been doing this since 1945, turning Nazi scientists and spies against Russia for our cause. And one more point, I think that the whole thing illustrates an important concept is the sunk cost fallacy. We put so much into this business, into this relationship, into this war, into this campaign, that we can't give it up now. We've invested too much. And this is part of what's going on. We cannot comprehend or accept that this has not been a good investment of lives and money and anything of the sort. But this requires stepping down from our superiority complex and wanting to be the sole superpower.
It is the overriding goal of the U.S., even though many people don't believe that. But it's how it, the only way it can be explained. And the it's a long-running thing, like the Minsk II agreement, which was signed by Russia, Ukraine, Germany, and
France.
They were, everything would have been set in place, and there wouldn't have been the war, but that was all undermined, as Angela Merkel stated, years later, that they weren't really pushing that. And so it built up the Ukrainians, and that started this long war in the, against the Russian-speaking Donbass and other areas in the eastern.
The advantage from the Western point of view is with extreme cynicism, murderous cynicism, that the Ukrainians can be the ones to fight the Russians and engage in our overall strategy and campaign to try to weaken Russia, which has been stated several times by key U.S. leaders, although it's not discussed very much. The campaign, the strategy, since 1990 has been to weaken Russia, gain access to the resources of the world's greatest commodity producer, and dismember Russia if necessary. They have conferences in Europe about dismembering Russia into smaller states.
Lindsey Graham, who is still Republican, a U.S. senator from South Carolina, who was very early over there, pictured in the dugouts. I've seen pictures along with our Amy Klobuchar, senator from Minnesota, But he said that Ukraine, sure is suffering some losses, but they could fight until the last Ukrainian, that this would be a worthy goal. Now, this was posted 2 days ago on the 9th, and we're going to get back to that. But we have another contributor to this station, this program, Dave Logsdon. And you have a couple things to tell us about coming up.
Yes. Good afternoon, Don. Good program so far. I love what I'm hearing. I agree with everything Dave says. We have a couple things going. As anybody's been paying attention in the peace movement and peace groupies in the city, in the state, the schedule is very, very full. And at any given time, there's one or two different actions and things going on. So I'm going to highlight a few that are going to be happening. One is going to happen this weekend up in Camp Ripley, which is just past Little Falls. You can't miss it. You're going up 169, I think, and you can, you'll see the signs that follow there. But at 10 o'clock on Sunday till 2, we'll have a demonstration. We do this every other year in coalition with the Brainerd Peace Coalition. We do this, we skip a year, then this is another year, and we'll be going up there. And so we'll have a group of people, also WAM and Anti-War Committee from our neighborhood here. The Brainerd Lakes Area Democratic Socialists will be there as well as the Brainerd Area Peace Coalition.
Dave, say just a little bit about Camp Ripley.
Camp Ripley is a training grounds for the National Guard. I'm a Navy guy, so I don't know a lot of details about Army bases, but they train the National Guard there. And so they have an open house every other year. And I'm anticipating they're going to be stepping up the security. They always are a little bit nervous. We don't do anything. We did penetrate the interior, almost the main gate, with our peace tank. The creation of Joe Schubert and Roger Cuthbertson, that is a replica of a tank made with cloth and PVC pipe, and it has a little a cannon that we load up with flowers and then shoot out with a leaf blower, and it actually shoots flowers. So it's the peace tank. And so we got all the way to the security gate, and they decided that we would not be a welcome addition to their open house, so we turned around.
So Camp Ripley is the largest military base in Minnesota.
Yeah.
And it's what they have is an open house, and they encourage a lot of young kids, teenagers, whatever, to go out there and get in these tanks and pretend like they're shooting, maybe actually shooting.
Yeah.
So it's sort of a recruiting.
Yeah, it's a fun day. So it's like Disneyland with guns, you know. it's something that we, of course, at Vets for Peace, were adamantly opposed to that type of hardwiring our youth towards war.
What else do you have that's going on?
Oh, I got other stuff here, too. So a week from Wednesday, so next week, Wednesday, on the 60th, 70th, I think the 17th, is there'll be a protest by Allianz Field, the soccer stadium for the Loon. A working group within Vets for Peace has organized a group to do a protest on Allianz Field. Now, why were we protesting in front of a soccer stadium? Well, it's because the name, Allianz Field, Allianz bought the naming rights with money, probably profits they got from doing business with Israel. And the naming rights to that stadium is a way to sports wash what is the dirty business that Allianz is involved in. So on Saturday, there'll be a from 1 to 3 at the Rondo Community Library. That will be a art build. I think that'll be for making signs and doing artwork. And I think they're going to be doing some canvassing in the neighborhood to let the neighbors around Allianz Field know that this this stadium that is in a name of a company that's helping fuel and fund genocide in Gaza.
Oh, good. Thank you for that, Dave Logsdon. And now we're going to get back to Brian Berletic being questioned by Professor Glenn Deason. This is posted 2 days ago on September 9th. NATO panics as Ukraine frontline collapses.
There we go. Thank you, Don.
Just have to get beyond a little static here.
Guys, so for example, he met with, in his first administration, a North Korean leader. Now he's meeting with Putin. And I think this is, this for me, this is a thing which we have, one of those things we refer to as a moral virtue, that we don't talk to bad people, and so, but that also means we don't do diplomacy. So for, so I like this aspect, but on the other hand, it also appeared in the media recently that while he was in North Korea to meet Kim Jong-un, he also had his Navy SEALs do an operation against North Korea in which they killed a lot of civilians, fishermen, and then pulled away. But it's a little bit like the deception of Iran. I'm happy they want to talk and find a peace agreement, but when you're planning a strike in the middle of this, it is a bit deceptive. But on the topic though of peace efforts, the main, I guess, next step in this narrative of, you know, first he met with Zelensky and Putin in Alaska, then he met with Zelensky and the Europeans at the White House. Now this big new step is to have Zelensky and Putin meet. I guess, what is the purpose of this this meeting? Because usually you would have the state leaders would come and meet each other once all the main issues have been resolved, and they come for the grand finale to shake hands and put their signature down. You know, the optics of it, but. But when neither side is prepared to make any real concessions, including the United States, what are they actually meeting for? What's the purpose of this peace initiative, if you call it?
Well, first, addressing President Trump's willingness to speak with supposed American adversaries or declared American adversaries. We have to think back to the time when then U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton met with Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov, and they reset U.S.-Russian relations. And this was following another U.S. proxy war against Russia, this time using Georgia as a battering ram in 2008 against Russian forces along their southern border in the Caucasus region. And that was a failure, and the U.S. hit a brick wall, and they needed to reset their relations. So someone like U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, who we know isn't interested in diplomacy at all, met with Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov. What was the purpose of this? It was to draw in the Russians and trick them. And that is exactly why President Trump is now meeting with people. And as you point out, even as he was meeting with North Korea's leadership, he had people inside North Korea murdering North Koreans. And then as he was talking with the Iranians, all along preparing to strike at and kill Iranians and wage war against Iran. So there is no actual interest in diplomacy. It is all a trick. It is to draw in other nations. It is to make the United States look like it is the reasonable one. And it is these nations that are intent on continuing the war. And I have a funny feeling that that is why President Trump wants President Putin to meet with President Zelensky. And I forget who says it. I don't think that President Putin would have said something like this, because he's usually very polite no matter how upset he is. But someone somewhere said that this would be like a dog is barking at you, and you get on your knees, your hands on your knees, and you bark back at the dog instead of talking to the person holding the leash. This is the equivalent of the Russians meeting with Ukraine's leadership when they're not actually in charge of anything. The people holding the leash is the United States. This is a U.S. war fought against Russia through Ukraine. And no amount of talking to Ukraine is going to change that. This needs to be resolved with the United States. And what we have seen is, despite Russia coming to these meetings and going through the motions, it is determined to solve this conflict on the battlefield. And that is what we are watching right now. They are remaining open to diplomacy. They know it will go nowhere, and they will settle this on the battlefield. And that, I think that is ultimately where this conflict will be settled.
Yeah, I haven't read that quote yet, but it sounds like something that Lavrov or Peskov would say, I guess.
Yes.
I guess what I've been looking for, though, from the United States is a good indication of the, you know, genuinely wanting to reset proper relations with Russia, would be to have them articulate some kind of a concept of what they believe peace is. Because traditionally, if you have as many centers of power, peace, all people would have recognized, is dependent on pursuing some path of indivisible security, somewhere you make sure that one side doesn't enhance its security at the expense of the other. So, for example, arms control, you would do, both sides would reduce, and thus they would maintain the same amount of security, but reducing the weapons. So overall, one side wouldn't get advantage over the other. I mean, this is why you have common security architectures and all. But, you would look for arguments that they should harmonize interest. Where can we mitigate competition? Where can we end it? But instead, over the past 30 years, we have the opposite, which is the hegemonic peace. And in the hegemonic peace, you don't need to take into account the security concerns of the other guy. You just make sure you're so dominant, it doesn't really matter what the other weaker counterpart thinks. So I haven't really seen any concept of security come out which kind of repudiates this the past 30 years. And I heard Marco Rubio refer to saying that we're in a multipolar world, but thereafter one almost get the idea that the strategy is, well, how can we restore the unipolarity then, as opposed to how do we learn to live with the other? So this is, I guess, one of my great disappointments, because if you don't learn to adjust to the multipolar realities, I think the United States will also get crushed at the end by getting too many enemies and also incentivizing these enemies to align themselves against America. I heard the media now criticize or ask different leaders such as J.D. Vance whether or not the United States, Putin, is stringing along Trump in these talks. Again, it does appear that the Russians have been fairly consistent all along, but what are you reading into these comments that the Russians are stringing along? Is this now the Russians not wanting peace and buying time, or have they changed their demands? This seems to become a new talking point. Whenever the media begin to coalesce around one talking point, it's worth, I guess, exploring what it actually means.
Well, first of all, you're absolutely right. If the U.S. was actually interested in peace, it would be pursuing entirely different policies. And it isn't. So it's obvious that they have no interest in peace at all. And yes, Secretary of State Marco Rubio acknowledged the existence of the multipolar world, but only as an obstacle to climb over to reestablish American dominance over the planet. And they are obviously openly pursuing that across the four corners of the globe. Now, as far as Russia stringing the Americans along, as you said, Russia has been consistent all along. They have never changed their original demands. Everything that they had said in the very beginning remains in place, unchanged. And all they want is this proxy war being waged against them by the United States to end, and the very source driving this proxy war to be ended. And that is America's insistence on dominating the planet, dominating Europe, pushing its influence up to and all along Russia's borders, and even inside Russian borders. They demand that this stops. This is existential for them. This is not something that they're imagining. As we watch Syria disappear off the map, Libya already gone, U.S. forces still in Iraq, Iran being attacked out of the blue during negotiations. Russia isn't imagining this. And this is what they have demanded from day one. And the Americans refuse to acknowledge or accept this, and they will continue pushing. So they want the illusion of peace with Russia so they can freeze the conflict, so they can circle back around and finish it later. This is their intent. And at this point, it should be obvious to everybody, because like you said, if they were actually interested in working together with the rest of the world rather than imposing itself upon it, there would be definite policies at least being talked about. They're not even talking about policies like this. They're openly pursuing policies that feed into continued American primacy. Absolutely everything that they're doing, they're rebuilding their whole military to wage large-scale war against peer adversaries like Russia and China. The ERAM missile that they're talking about sending to Ukraine, somewhere around 3,000 of them eventually, obviously not in the beginning. This is a munition that has been developed specifically for the type of warfare the U.S. envisions. It itself will be fighting against nations like Russia and China in the near future. So they are fully preparing to continue this, continuing it more forcefully if necessary. And if they can buy time and perform strategic sequencing, that would be ideal. And that is where we are right now.
Wanted to comment on a key theme there that Brian Berletic illustrated, and there's even more examples of this duplicity and betrayal, which has actually characterized U.S. international behavior, despite a lot of statements about wanting to negotiate and pretending that they didn't know what Russian demands were, and, you know, saying the problem with negotiations is Russia doesn't want to, and things of that sort. He gave some examples like Trump won, in my opinion, was undermined throughout by people like Pompeo and Brennan against real peace initiatives breaking through. So that was a big problem that he faced by appointing the wrong people in his first administration. And in the second administration of Trump, I think we're seeing more what Brian's talking about, which is duplicity. At the same time that he went to talk to the North Korean leader, they were having a SEAL team attack North Korea, and the mission went wrong, and they ended up murdering a number of North Korean fishermen. Another example, which he did not mention, but which Trump was responsible for, when there was an important peace initiative on the part of Iran wanting to talk with Saudi Arabia, which had not been happening for years and years, and Soleimani, the most popular after the Khomeini in Iran, was visiting for the purpose of opening some real negotiations and talks between those two traditionally enemies, and we killed them. So we pretended we were in favor of peace and so on, but, you know, we killed the most popular politician in Iran to help prevent that. Another example is the recent Iran negotiations were being publicly held. And on Thursday, it was like, okay, see you Monday. And then the next day, Israel, with the knowledge of the U.S., you know, launched this tremendous attack on their government officials and buildings and the military bases and so on. This is, again, while we're pretending to negotiate. And another example is Israel pretending to have Hamas negotiations and probably, again, with U.S. complicity, setting up the negotiators for attempted assassination in Doha, country of Qatar, which appears to have actually largely failed. But here again we have another blatant act of international terrorism and assassination while we're pretending to support negotiations. So what I can't understand is why anyone in the near foreseeable future would trust Israel or the U.S. anymore on any kind of promises or negotiations without the most ironclad security enforcement of whatever concessions were made. We have just proven over and over and over that you cannot trust the United States.
Now, there's a lot of chatter in the media about, well, what does Russia want? Well, they've been pretty strong in saying they want Ukraine to be neutral, that they... I've said that along. They've been, for decades, they've been talking about the Ukraine had been, they wanted to be neutral. They protested, the Russians had, under Putin and some a little bit before, but NATO moving towards the east, and it's the whole idea of creating a new enemy out of Russia. Well, Russia wants to have neutral Ukraine because it juts way into Russia. And so the missile launchers that the U.S. has put into Romania and Poland would only take about 9 minutes to get to Moscow. But if you're on Eastern the Ukraine, it'd take 5 minutes, so much more of a hair trigger on getting war. The other thing that they've been saying is to get rid of the Nazis involved. We've had other programs over the last few weeks about how much there is in the Nazis and how much they control what does go on.
You're having trouble imagining Russian security concerns, which a lot of U.S. people seem to have difficulty grasping. Just think of USSR missiles in Cuba. How could it be more clear that that was a big threat to us? Or let's say they make a deal currently with Mexico and there's missiles right across the Rio Grande from key U.S. sites. Wouldn't that be a serious threat that we wouldn't simply allow to happen? Well, Russia happens to be an equal, if not greater, nuclear superpower, and they have security concerns with missiles just a few minutes away from their major capital.
Now, just in case you don't know that about, when the Soviet Union placed some missiles in Cuba, this was the Cuban Missile Crisis. And for, I don't know, 9 days, living through it, you didn't know if this is going to be the end. And it was just through some happenstance. There was a Russian sub-commander that did not go after some provocations of anti-submarine warfare, but...
Or uncertainty about what the message was. But also what was not revealed until later and denied to the American people was that the understanding and the basis of the missiles being withdrawn from Cuba was the withdrawal of U.S. missiles from Turkey. It was a tit for tat. It was mutual recognition of security concerns, which is what we're talking about here. But that lesson, that most important lesson of the Cuban Missile Crisis, where we almost all went up in smoke, was denied, kept out of the U.S. press for quite a few years. So people failed to learn the most elementary lesson of mutual respect and understanding of security concerns by major power.
President John F. Kennedy.
Yeah, he ordered the press not to cover it.
And that was because he thought it would be too critical, because he had such...
Yeah, too embarrassing. We're too arrogant to admit that we have to understand and respect mutually other countries' security concerns. This is the fundamental thing going on. Are we going to get back to more like the Westphalian concept of mutual recognition, or are we going to stick to this destructive, murderous, we're the sole superpower, and don't anybody say anything different?
Before we get back to our... I want to tell you, to talk today, I want to tell you that the KFAI fall membership drive begins a week from yesterday. So next week for this show will be the first of two shows. So from the Wednesday, September 17th to the 26th. And it's...
Sorry about that.
It's all right. And so it's... We will be looking for all the help we can get because we have been cut back by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting going out of business because of Trump. So here's Brian Berletic being interviewed by Professor Glenn Deason.
United States is not actually pursuing a peace. It is interesting that the format they have for finding this peace. I mean, part of the reason why they're saying they're putting pressure on the European Zelensky and now, you know, threatening to destroy the Russian economy, sending all these new missiles, this kind of seems to coincide with the peace initiative, given that you have to pressure all sides to get closer together. But again, as you mentioned before, given that Trump has previously recognized that this is a proxy war, why is the U.S. not having any role in actually making any concessions? Because it looks as if it has solely taken on the role as a mediator. But the whole idea of bringing Ukraine and the Russian position closer, again, my question is always, why is not bringing Ukraine into NATO the responsibility of NATO? Why does Ukraine have to renounce the path of to join NATO? Why isn't it upon the United States and NATO to say, well, actually, we're going to have to have a proper pan-European security architecture where we don't push our military blocks on the Russian borders, again, indivisible security. Why is this Ukraine's responsibility? What if the United States actually wanted to bring this war to an end? What could it do besides playing the mediator?
Well, I mean, that's it exactly, isn't it? The U.S. is pursuing this war against Russia while also posing as mediator. That right there is a fundamental obstacle to achieving anything. Because if you're not even being honest about what the conflict is, you're admitting that it's a proxy war, that it's your proxy war against Russia. You're blaming the Biden administration for starting it, which gives you an easy exit out of it. You could just say this was Biden's policy and we reject it. It was terrible. Look at what it has caused and we are exiting from it. But the reality is the same special interests that compelled the Biden administration to launch this proxy war, compelling the Trump administration to continue it. And again, just as we've already seen in this specific conflict, not even talking about elsewhere, the U.S. has used this cycle of propaganda, feigned desire for peace, and then continued war. They've already done this in regards to Ukraine, the Minsk I and Minsk II agreements. They're recreating this. And just because Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth back in February said this must not be Minsk 3.0 doesn't mean that it isn't exactly Minsk 3.0, because then he explains what it is. It is freezing the conflict along the line of contact. It is moving European troops into Ukraine to basically create a bluff against Russia. If you continue, if you try to restart this, you're going to have to fight through European, essentially NATO troops. And Europe is going to continue arming and backing the Ukrainians, and they're going to rebuild and reorganize their military during this pause. So all that is Minsk 3.0. And so what it is, what the Trump administration is doing is trying to have it both ways, trying to absolve itself from responsibility for causing this or continuing this conflict, blame it on Russia for this conflict continuing, posing as some sort of mediator that is, we're just so frustrated that the Europeans and Ukrainians, who we completely control, won't make peace with Russia because we told them not to. I mean, this is exactly what's playing out, and the short and simplest answer is the U.S., this current administration and all administrations before, they're just simply lying. They're lying about their intentions, and through their actions, we can see what their true intentions actually are, and that is to freeze this war, to wage much more dangerous wars elsewhere, and then circle back around to Ukraine and Russia again, because they've already done this cycle once already with the Minsk agreements.
Yeah, Trump seems always to pride himself of this strategic ambiguity and being powerful yet peaceful. So he wants to balance too much, which is why, you know, he makes always the argument the war would never have happened if I was president. This was foolish by Biden. And then in the same breath, he will then take credit for no one sent more weapons. Obama didn't send anything. I sent the javelins in my first administration. So he's the one who, even Obama, who backed the coup in Ukraine, recognized that this would be foolish because he would, if you escalate it towards a direct confrontation or heighten, go up the escalation ladder, it would be foolish in Obama's mind because the Russians would have the benefit of proximity, which is important for logistics. And also, at the end of the day, it would be more important for the Russians than the United States because it's, again, it's on the other side of the planet for America, while for Russia, it's an existential threat. So they would be willing to go all the way. And they would have the benefit of not just industrial production, but also logistics. But again, Trump seems to want it both ways. He's a brilliant, brutal, and tough. At the same time, he wants to be the man of peace. So it does appear, though, based on, I think we agree that the diplomatic efforts aren't really going anywhere. Now, I hope I'm wrong, but if this is the case, the war will then be decided on the battlefield. But how far are we away from something like this? What do you see at the moment on the front lines?
Well, as you noted earlier, Russia carried out one of, if not the largest, drone and missile strike so far. But isn't that something we find ourselves saying almost every single month now? And this is because of Russia's military-industrial capacity. It's not just enormous, but it continues to expand. And this is what myself and others, yourself, Alex and Alexander of the Duran, they've been following this for 3+ years now. Alexander Mikuras called it aggressive attrition. That is exactly what the Russians are doing. I still see Western analysts claiming, well, Russia is failing because they cannot break through. They're not breaking through here. Look at how little territory they've taken this month. It isn't about territory. It isn't about breaking through. It is about grinding Ukraine's fighting capacity down to where it eventually collapsed. This is what we actually saw in Syria, and in this case, it worked in favor of U.S. foreign policy objectives. That conflict was frozen for years. The front line didn't move anywhere. And then suddenly, because the Syrian Arab Army was hollowed out over years and years, and because Russia and Iran were distracted elsewhere, eventually a hard push came and everything just collapsed. And that is possible in Ukraine. That is possible. And that is why the United States is telling Europe, you need to create a coalition of the willing. A lot of people imagine that Europe came up with this on their own. This was in the public directive Secretary Hegseth gave in February. He told the Europeans, you're going to send troops into Ukraine. And the reason they're sending troops into Ukraine is because they know that eventually Ukrainian lines are going to collapse. The military will collapse. We're already hearing admissions from Ukraine itself. They have so little manpower along the line of contact. There are entire sections of the front that just aren't even manned. There are defenses in place, but there are no people in those defenses. And that's why when you look at the map, you will see Russia break through, and then it'll start to expand. And then the Ukrainians, like a fire brigade, they have to send their reserves to that area, and then Russia will withdraw. They're not trying to break through and take that territory. They're trying to overstretch Ukrainian lines, and it's working. And we can see demonstrably so that the metrics of Ukraine's military power waning day by day. And there's nothing that the West can do about it except intervene directly and hope that the Russians pause for thought and stop instead of fighting through European troops at that point.
I think that... sorry, I lost my train of thought there for a second, but I think that the explanation that Brian offers throughout the program is really important, that the U.S., despite public statements and despite some negotiation meetings or just diplomatic meeting, has throughout undermined real settlement, real end to the war. They could have done so in 2014 and 2015 with the Minsk agreements, which we've explained were simply a ruse were used to undermine Russia and rearm Ukraine. They could have had an agreement in 2022 at the beginning of the current period when they had an agreement in Istanbul, and then the West told the Ukrainians, don't go along with this. We'll back you, as was said, to the last Ukrainian. And I don't think that they're sincere now. And so we have this, they're at loggerheads because, again, despite pretense, we really don't want to have peace with Russia. We want to have a freeze while we concentrate on some other things. For example, they're threatening another bombing and regime change operation in Venezuela right now. So the question is, what's the priority? And sometimes we've decided Ukraine isn't the priority it once was, and that's why we want Europe to step in.
Yes, that is... maybe we could talk about how, in the last few minutes, this is the three-year anniversary of the Nord Stream pipeline being blown up. Why don't you talk about that?
Well, just as we're willing to sacrifice Ukraine and Ukrainians as part of our larger war and strategy to undermine and weaken Russia, we're actually quite willing to weaken and undermine Europe as well. And the proof is in the destruction of the Nord Stream pipeline, which was allowing, enabling German and other European economies to thrive on cheap fossil fuel. And it's the natural economic relationship that was allowed to build up until the current war period. And I pointed out once before that this was identified as a threat to Western interests. That is, the gas from Russia was identified as far back as the 1980s by none other than Anthony Blinken, wrote a book called Ally versus Ally. And it was subsequent to that that there was, through some devious, very indirect means, explosions in the first Siberian pipeline, which at that point was going to begin to supply Europe. So we actually did this once before. And then, of course, 3 years ago, we destroyed the biggest infrastructure act of terrorism and one of the worst environmental catastrophes of our time when U.S. with friends blew up the pipelines.
This was a majority not owned by Russia, but it came from Russia with oil and gas. There's two pipelines, and they were Biden's, he just said that something was going to happen to stop that.
Yeah, standing next to him, Olaf Scholz, chancellor at Germany at that point, was forced to remain in humble silence while Biden assured, and even in response to a reporter's question, that we were not going to allow that pipeline to operate. And so we're willing to weaken Europe. Once again, Europe is being sacrificed to our largest strategy of war on Russia. They're in big trouble over there. They're having to cut all their social services and pensions and holidays and things like that for the sake of more war.
Well, this has been the Northern Sun Radio News Show with your host, Don Olson, and Dave Gudnick there. And I want you to stay tuned for Global Beat.
Welcome to MN90, Minnesota History in 90 Seconds.
In the 1920s, a handful of dubious local Minnesota publications, like the Twin City Reporter, published sensationalistic headlines and scandalous stories. And journalist Jay Neer's articles about organized crime's influence on Twin Cities government and police were tinged with offensive, racist language. Minnesota's 1925 gag law was passed precisely to silence people like Neer. The law empowered the government to censor works it deemed scandalous, libelous, or otherwise presented a public nuisance. So when Neer wanted to publish his new scandal sheet, the Saturday Press, local officials used the gag law to prevent Neer from publishing his first issue. Neer sued. After a lengthy legal battle in state courts, the U.S. Supreme Court heard the case in 1931 and sided with Neer, ruling that censorship is unconstitutional in most cases.
You cannot underestimate the importance